This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, a completely incident-free weekend of Premier League football to look back on, in which no one got angry, no managers lied about what happened in front of all of our eyes, no one waited for ages for perfectly good goals to be disallowed, no one, nothing, carry on. And amongst it all, some brilliant football, Anthony kissing the badge, Eriksen pulling the strings, four wins on the bounce for Manchester United, dispatching this season's invincibles. Ivan Toney get on that plane, five or kind of six for goal-shy Brighton, and no one saw it coming, come back from Bournemouth, a wild end at Stamford Bridge, City held up by Stevie G and Spurs clicking into gear. There's a breathless derby at Goodison, Che Adams missing from a centimetre and Newcastle robbed at St James's Park. And we'll finish today's pod with a simply stunning musical finale. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Jay says, this is the A-team. David says, the A-team. Stephen says, I haven't seen a lineup this good since Boys Life formed, which is Brian McFadden and Shane Duffy, one from Westlife and one from Boyzone. And I do have a Westlife anecdote, which I don't believe I've told, but we'll save that for later. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, welcome.
Barney, how you doing?
Very good. Barney Ronay, hello.
Hi, hi everyone.
Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hello, Max.
Ollie says, I'm looking forward to this edition of Guardian Referee Weekly. Can you make sure you don't follow the mistake of other outlets and let the football distract from the thing we all want to talk about? A big weekend for VAR. I'm trying to see on the Zoom call who is less excited about this being the big talking point. Brad says, do you think VAR has been a net positive for the pod? Are discussions about VAR being bad more enjoyable to take part in than should VAR be introduced? So according to the Premier League, in 2018-19, before VAR was introduced, the percentage of correct key match decisions was 82%. With the help of VAR in 1920, it was 94%. But over the weekend, we had quite a few decisions. Does anyone have any sort of new thoughts on the matter? Barney, he puts his hand up immediately.
It's not really a new thought. But there was a good bit. When Anthony Taylor was kind of pouring, it took 5 minutes for him to go to think about something that was kind of very vague and subjective, and who knows, maybe this, maybe that. 5 minutes staring at his VAR screen, and it was described, the fact that he did not then change his decision, he stuck to his decision, was described by the Match of the Day commentator as refreshing after 5 minutes of staring. Have you seen Stranger Things? There's a lot of talk in that about the hive mind, the evil substance that's seeping through the gateway is part of a hive mind. If you kill one part of it in Russia, you kill the other part in America. It's all one substance. And this is what VAR chat is as well. Does it matter? Would it be interesting if we went through which of these very, very boring situations Anthony Taylor was looking at, or which one Paul Tierney was looking at? Would that matter? The answer is no. It's a hive mind and you have to kill one bit of it. But the point is, how unrefreshed do you have to be in life generally to find Anthony Taylor looking at the VAR screen for 5 minutes and then sticking with his decision? Refreshing. I feel sorry for all of us in that situation.
So look, over the weekend, we had Corne's disallowed goal for West Ham against Chelsea, Tariq Mitchell's own goal for Palace at Newcastle. The PGMOL has acknowledged that these were both mistakes after the Premier League asked the officiating board to investigate them and has said they will cooperate with all inquiries, like they've been arrested or something. Wilson, any firm thoughts on this?
Not really. It's just one of those subjects where I just come to hate everybody involved. I hate the players, I hate the referees, I hate the managers, I hate the journalists, and I hate the fans and the people and the world in general. I mean, there's so many things where people just say the most absurd. Yeah, you mentioned in the introduction, people just lying. People just saying things happened that didn't happen. People claiming the laws say a thing that they don't say. So that's really annoying. This idea that, oh, well, we should only give them 30 seconds to do it, or we should only give them a minute to do it. It's nonsense. If you're going to stop the game, you might as well get it right. You know, suddenly there's this extraordinary pressure on some poor TV director to find the right angle. That something might be obvious from angle six, but not from angles 1 to 5. But because it took them an extra kind of couple of seconds to load that up, the VAR official doesn't have access to that. It's nonsense. I have no understanding whatsoever of how you can look at that West Ham goal that was ruled out and see that as a foul. It's just bewildering to me. It just doesn't make any sense to me. The Newcastle one, I can see how you see, was it Joe Willock clatter into Gaeta and you think, oh, well, that's a foul. You probably should then see the reason why Willock clatters into him, which is being shoved by Mitchell. What I'm then slightly baffled by with that is whether you have to give a penalty rather than giving the goal. But I think you probably can give a goal because it's not a foul because he hasn't deliberately jumped into him. But I just don't understand how we have this game with all this money floating around in it and get decisions like that. But at the same time, I sort of hate this culture of blaming referees and calling referees out. Because these clearly are the best referees we have available. You know, they're assessed on a match-by-match basis, and the best ones stay in the Premier League and the weaker ones are replaced by the best ones from the Championship. That's how it works. So if you relegate them, you're replacing them with people who aren't as good as them. So this is the best available option. We have to have referees. These are the best referees we have. We've kind of got to put up with it, and we've got to somehow work out a way of not having this mass hysteria that makes their job even harder.
Henrik says, is the truth that we don't actually want the laws of the game to be followed in too much detail? That feels slightly accurate with that McAllister goal, Barry, because I think letter of the law, that probably is offside, but none of us want it to be disallowed because it's really good. And Henry says, scrap VAR, except that occasionally refs will make mistakes, just like players do. If we want better refs, improve the culture at grassroots levels to stop the horrendous verbal physical abuse, maybe we'd have a more talented pool of refs to choose from. I mean, both those seem like really sensible points.
VAR isn't going to be scrapped, and I don't think they're particularly sensible points. We'll take the McAllister goal first. Mwepo, it took 4 minutes and 30 seconds for the VAR officials to decide Mwepo was offside. That is ridiculous. It's just too long. And whether even if McAllister had shinned one in, you know, from 6 yards, I still would think it would be ridiculous. So that's my take on that. And VAR isn't going to be abandoned, so, you know, that's not an option. But if it was, you know, we need to remember that why it was introduced in the first place, because referees were getting horrendous amounts of abuse and people thought VAR would be the solution to all their problems. Now, it was pretty obvious it was just going to create a new set of problems, but people couldn't see this. So now we are where we are because people wanted it and they got what they wanted and they're still not happy. But it is here to stay. It's not going anywhere, whether you think it should be abandoned or not. But I was always against it because I could see what was going to happen. But people were ridiculing me on this podcast, as they often do, for many reasons. But I was the subject of much ridicule because I could sort of see what was going to happen.
I agree with Barry.
Wilson, why did you wanted to say they weren't sensible points?
I mean, they're not, because the problem is one of perception that for all the abuse the referees got, there was an understanding that it's difficult because your eye line might be blocked, or you know you're a 40-year-old bloke running as fast as you can, and your head might sort of jiggle at the wrong moment. The human error was easier to accept.
Who are these referees? Sort of like, I don't know, like old weevils or whatever. Their heads just jiggling at the wrong moment, running as fast as they can. These are the refs we want. Wobble-headed men, cavalierly, just careering everywhere as fast as they can.
Have you tried to recruit bald, pedantic, middle-aged men? There's not that many of them who are that. That's where referees have to come from, and there are not that many of them who are particularly athletic.
It is a really unusually bald profession, isn't it? I did notice that yesterday. I was looking at Paul Tierney and thinking, well, yeah, what a bald profession. I can't think of any other profession as bald as refereeing.
A lot of policemen bald.
It's difficult to tell because they often wear hats.
Nightclub doormen.
Nightclub. Yeah, bouncers, that's true. Right. Yeah. Bouncers and referees are very
important. Maybe referees should wear hats so then they get less abuse.
Obviously, we don't, if they're wearing hats, I mean, given all the sunshine, given climate change allegedly exists, but we'll get to that, won't we? Sorry, Wilson.
So I think more referees are, sorry, more decisions are got right. It's just that our expectations are higher because we think, oh, you know, this sort of big brother cameras everywhere should be infallible. And it's just more frustrating because it's harder to understand how you can look at that West Ham decision and watch replays of that and think that's a foul. Whereas referee running in real time, he sees a player jumping over another player, one player goes down clutching his shoulder. It's easier to understand the mistake. But fundamentally, more decisions are got right now. And that point about people don't want decisions to be correct. I mean, the McAllister decision was just correct. Just because he hit the ball nicely, it's still correct. He's,
The idea that the truth is we kind of want football to feel right rather than the laws be stuck to accurately. Barney?
The margins that we're talking about are very hard to call. So then you say, is the idea that a really good goal, which starts around the halfway line, there's an offside, a brilliant goal is scored, which involves defeating the opposition in some way, doing moments of skill, playing football. If we then call it back and say, technically, it's offside because under the current technology that we have, we can identify a toenail that's offside. That's not what the offside law was intended for. And you might find that a sensible judge would say, we can't say with absolute certainty. And this different occasions, if a player is in front of the goalkeeper distracting them, if it's very close to goal, then that is what the offside law is intended for. And it's worth being totally minute on it and strict liability.
You can't have goals being allowed or not allowed according to the quality of the strike.
Not the quality of the goal, the situation in the game.
Barney, are you saying you want judges to do VAR? That's what I take.
No, there's an idea of sensibly interpreting the laws.
But Barry, you wanted to pipe in.
Well, I just think I'm with Barney on that, although I do think it's a bit too idealistic a pipe dream to hope that we would, take. If you start, we're into the field of interpretation there, so. Which that's a whole other issue with VAR, but I just think if it takes 5 minutes to decide if someone who didn't really affect the play was offside, then they are probably not offside.
All right, then let's talk about the actual football, shall we? We'll begin at Old Trafford. Manchester United 3, Arsenal 1. Thomas says, where will this season's Arsenal Invincibles rank in the annals of history? What was this, Barney? A case of both teams being quite good in different ways and one of them just winning in the big moments?
Yeah, I thought it was a good game and I thought both teams were good. And you don't always say that. And there's been a lot of games between these teams where you felt this feels like a meandering sideshow at times in the last 10 years. But I was there and I felt that this, for the first time in a long time, felt like a real event. And I felt both of these teams are good. And it's going to be a battle of which team is better rather than which team is at the most troublesome stage in its ongoing fraught rebuilding process. And it felt like the cutting edge or something. There were lots of energetic, good young players. And I think that Erik ten Hag he knows what he's doing. This is something. Like good decisions are being made. And as does Mikel Arteta. I really like his Arsenal team. What I like about them is that they will succeed or fail on their own terms. Like this is simply his team. He's created a thing which will work because it's Arteta's Arsenal or won't. And that's quite an achievement at a club which has had a manager for so long and a dynasty like that. And I also really like what Ten Hag is doing with Ronaldo. And I've now decided that I've got a new Ronaldo theory, because you must always have a Ronaldo theory. It's actually really good that he's there.
Wilson needs a new Ronaldo theory, if anyone does. Sorry,
what's happening is Manchester United have been fighting the same war since the 1950s. Just because Ferguson won that war against the past and created a good version of what people feel Manchester United should be, doesn't mean that war wasn't going on. So he managed to win that war. Subsequent managers have also been struggling with this fetishizing of the past. In a way, Ronaldo being there is very lucky. He is that glorious past made flesh. It's there, it's embodied, it's in front of you. It's like you can slay the dragon literally by dealing with Ronaldo. It's not a vague thing, noises of not Paul Scholes on BT Sports saying stuff. It's Ronaldo. He's in front of you. This says, I am what you once had and what you might have again. And Ten Hag's stuff about him in the week, like he wants to make him his pupil and teach him how to play football, I just thought was so good because it's so insulting and so obviously designed to bring it to a head. Like, you must, Ronaldo is the only person in football who must be respected. You must always, if you disrespect him, everyone else can be disrespected, but not Ronaldo. And that was great, because, and then leaving on the bench and, you know, playing Marcus Rashford ahead of him, who's now playing very well, he can slay the dragon. It's in front of him. It's come to a head. It's like you must actually do this thing and then you can move on. So Ronaldo's kind of a gift if you deal with him properly. And I think there is evidence that may be happening.
QPR Stats says, is 35 minutes into your debut, having signed 72 hours earlier, a bit soon to be kissing the badge? Anthony, clearly he loves Manchester United. He bleeds red, doesn't he, Wilson? What did you make of his performance and Manchester United in general?
I thought he was pretty good. Took his goal nicely. I thought Ramsdale made it pretty easy for him, but you know, I think Zinchenko made it pretty easy for him, but you know, he made the run. He took it very, very nicely. I thought, yeah, all three United goals are those counter-attacking goals where they've got mobility up front. I know two of them came with Ronaldo on the pitch, but it's that sort of mobility that they had in their best moments under Solskjaer that they haven't had for a year. I guess if you can achieve that with Ronaldo there, that's the best of both worlds. I think it's a pretty hard balance to achieve, but that last sort of 20, 25 minutes, I mean, Larsson lost a bit of shape, I think, after substitutions. Yeah, they had that. So I think they'd be slightly concerned about periods in the first half, and especially that first sort of, well, you know, the second half up until they got their second, when Arsenal looked significantly the better side. But, you know, they now have the spirit, a resolve, a defensive organisation to hold out, and they can counter-attack again. And Rashford, yeah, suddenly is reborn.
Eriksen was great, Baz.
Yeah, I think he was the difference between the sides in the end. Just constantly picked the right pass, moved the ball incredibly quickly. The fact that Rashford seems to be refinding his mojo helped as well, obviously. And I thought Arsenal were good, but I think Mikel Arteta maybe hit the panic button a bit too early. So he's always on at us, to, you know, telling us when Arsenal weren't doing so well to trust the process. And it was like yesterday, didn't trust his own process. And as Jonathan said, they made those substitutions, lost their shape, and a minute later were 3-1 down, game over.
A weirdly interesting stat is Arsenal set a new Premier League record by scoring a 10th consecutive left-footed goal. You'd have thought a team would have to have Andros Townsend for that to be a thing, wouldn't you?
Be lucky to get 10 goals out of Andros Townsend, though, right?
clip that for Troy. But like you said, Barney, I mean, Arsenal don't need to panic, do they? They're top of the league. That is a one that Arteta has started this season brilliantly.
Yeah, they're a good team. And they do have a plan. Sometimes in football, just having a plan is enough if everyone agrees that it's the plan. And it will depend how they react to defeat. I don't think you can say for sure which of these teams will finish above each other in the league, really. I think probably Man United have more. I mean, there was a bit of a thing on the TV coverage of like, oh, just days after being in crisis, plucky Manchester United have recovered. And as though it's some amazing revival. When, you know, they've got Casemiro on the bench. You know, obviously that's a bit odd. Like, we've now this Scott McTominay was surprised as anyone to discover that he's a better midfielder than Casemiro. but he did play very well, actually, and he was key to Antony doing well. Although Antony did tackle back a lot. He had Scott McTominay right behind him, which is obviously a good thing if you're an attacking player, because he will be an obstacle behind you. But you know, Man United have loads of really good players and a massive budget. So it's not a miracle, it's not a fairy story that they should manage to win some games. But I think Arsenal are a good team. If they can score enough goals, if they're the regular goal scorers, Jesus, you know, is obviously their kind of big hope with that. But with Man United, I thought I saw a lot of goals in that team. They will score goals this season.
Arsenal fans would be furious if we didn't mention the disallowed goal, but Christian Eriksen was fouled, so let's carry on. Let's do the 2-5-2s. Brighton 5, Leicester 2. Jerry says, how close to the pod wrapping will Brendan Rodgers get fired? It's hard to work out, Barry, what the bigger story is here. Brighton in fourth, playing great football, or the crisis at Leicester?
I think the crisis at Leicester is the bigger story. I don't think people were expecting them to be this bad. I think people thought they would do a bit more, bring in a few more new faces during deadline day. And I think they signed one defender. He hasn't got his visa sorted yet, so he wasn't playing yesterday. But they were a mess yesterday, whatever about the scoreline, but just the performance was diabolical. Their defending was diabolical. Players weren't trying. They were all bickering and arguing with each other, pointing fingers of blame at each other. And you would have to say they look to be in big trouble. And I would not be at all surprised if, as is customary, with a manager getting sacked as soon as we've sent our recordings to producer Silas, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Brendan Rodgers got sacked. And I suspect he might want to get sacked, just with the comments he's been making. If he resigns, he won't get his payoff, obviously. So I have a feeling he would welcome his P45 and a big payout, because that is a shit show.
Yeah, it feels like everybody would welcome it. It feels like a lot of people who don't watch Leicester a lot sort of have some sympathy for Rodgers, but he doesn't necessarily that excited to be there. The fans don't necessarily want him to be there. And I wonder, Wilson, if Leicester fans are looking at the Premier League thinking, you know, you just have to be not as bad as the other three teams. And it is very early in the season. But like a lot of those teams that we thought would be really bad, certainly like Fulham, aren't. And that may not carry on, but actually you could be as potentially a slightly bigger side and really struggle this year.
Yeah, you could be. I think the what you know, the consequence of the €2.25 billion expenditure from Premier League clubs in the summer is that the middle class is bigger and better and more competitive than ever before. Now, that might not mean that they can necessarily compete with the top six, but it does mean that, yeah, it's not difficult for teams you sort of think of as being quite established Premier League clubs to get themselves into difficulty. That I think, you know, West Ham are seeing that this season. I don't think they're much worse than last season, but suddenly, rather than challenging for Europe, they're looking slightly anxiously over their shoulders. Like that, I'm sure West Ham will be fine. But the fact that Leicester were not involved in that spending and the fact they lost Fofana is clearly, you know, a huge issue for them. The fact that people like Tielemans, I thought Tielemans actually was okay. Yes, but Tielemans and Maddison clearly did want to leave. The fact they're still there, you don't quite know how they'll respond to the adversity. So, yeah, you do sort of feel that some kind of break is needed. And the thing with Rodgers, I mean, I always sort of think that, I said this about Frank Lampard, a good sort of quick gauge of the work that a manager's doing is how many goals you concede from set pieces. But that's the thing that managers should be able to put right. And Rodgers just hasn't put it right for, well, at least a season and a half. And that would really concern me.
On to Brighton, Barney, is Graham Potter getting more out of these players than he should or than other managers would? Or are they just good players who we would talk about more if they were at bigger clubs?
Yeah, I think they're good. They've got good recruitment. They're good players. They all are selected with a role in mind and a clear plan. And Brighton's just that kind of thing. Like sometimes you can get a leg up on the opposition in sport just with an absence of stupidity. It's what Manchester City have done at the top end. Like, it's almost cheating not having morons in charge of anything. It really works. And Brighton have sort of intelligent people in the right job doing the right things. And, you know, you look at Manchester United who are playing the game straight. They're being honest. They're employing traditionally confused, egotistical people in positions of authority, which is what football is about. And they're losing out to other teams who've kind of gamed this. They're doping the system by having competent people who know what they're doing and don't have a personal agenda. So it's kind of what Brighton are doing lower down the scale. And we marvel at their incredibly logical decision. We marvel at their lack of stupidity. But the players, similarly, at Brighton, whenever they speak quite a lot. You hear the players speak and they all seem in charge of what they're doing. They talk kind of like how I'm used to American sports people talking, where they seem to know what the game plan is and they talk about their personal brief and their statistics and how they want. And sometimes it's quite surprising because there's a culture of, you know, ingrained anti-intellectualism in English football where you wouldn't talk about that in the past. And Brighton is just a clever club, I think, with clever players and good players.
Barry?
And what happens with clubs like that sometimes is they become victims of their own success. And I wonder if, I think there's a strong possibility the England job will become available around Christmas time. And I wonder if perhaps Brighton might lose their manager to England at Christmas time. I don't know.
Let's stick with well-run clubs and Brentford. He beat Leeds 5-2. Ivan Toney's hat trick. Fred says, is Ivan going to Qatar, Barry? What do you reckon?
I wouldn't have him on the plane to Qatar, mainly because I think he should be on the plane to Qatar. I don't want England to win the World Cup. He's certainly knocking on the door, isn't he? Dominic Calvert-Lewin probably almost certainly won't be on the plane. He's not playing at the moment, and he hasn't been playing particularly well when he hasn't been injured. So there is certainly a vacancy, and I can't think of anyone better than Toney, really, to put have in that role. I mean,
Rashford is on form again. I mean, I don't know how many he will pick. Southgate.
Yeah, I've never been particularly convinced by Tammy Abraham. I'm not sure why, but I haven't. I would certainly give Toney an opportunity. I mean, the two goals he scored, the free kick and then his, I think I heard someone describe it as a video game goal. They were just outstanding. And he's good at set pieces. He can take penalties. I think if Harry Kane was injured, why not Ivan Toney?
Jesse Marsh, I think, was sent off, Wilson. And I actually felt for him in this game because Brentford get a penalty from, I know we've done the VAR bit, but you know, Brentford get the VAR bit, their penalty, which I think was a penalty. Leeds should have had a penalty. And I thought it really rubbed salt into wounds that the ref stopped the game for the most innocuous foul about 5 seconds after Leeds should have had that penalty as a free kick for Brentford.
Yeah, it's another one where I can't conceive how you can look at that. And I understand the ref not seeing it because the shirt pull, which, okay, was outside the box. His view may have been obstructed by the player pulling the shirt, but there's then a hand on the shoulder, there's a little clip of the ankle. Yeah, it's an obvious penalty. So I understand why Jesse Marsh is very frustrated by that. But you know, he's been a sort of prickly touchline presence all season, and you sort of felt the red card was coming in his direction at some point. So he probably overreacted to it, but it should have been a penalty.
Jesse Marsh predicted his own red card, didn't he, last week? He said, "You know, I'm not going to do his voice. I'm not going to."
please do, Barney. Barney Ronay's impressions is not. I don't think we'd go there this early, but I'm absolutely keen for it.
I'd love to. I'm addicted to watching Jesse Marsh. He's just I could watch him talking about anything. He's hilarious. I mean, he's always telling everyone what's happening. I'm saying this as someone who's always telling people what's happening, but I find him incredibly watchable. They just had a little clip of him on the Match of the Day version of this. He obviously did a really long rant, and they just thought, what are we going to do with this? We got to somehow have a bit of Jesse Marsh, but it's like a long, incoherent rant. So they just had him for about 5 seconds going, Brentford is a smart team. And then they kind of cut it, Thomas Frank saying something sensible. I'd love to hear all the other stuff he said. He was justified in his anger because it was unfair. But and I love listening to him talk, and he's often sensible. But I think the way he acts on the touchline is pretty silly, to be honest. And the fact is, people need to copy this stuff, and he needs to calm down. I think it will become a joke, and I don't think the players will be able to take it seriously after a while. So he needs to get a grip of himself, because he's becoming the story a bit with them, which is not good. Because Brentford did play really well, and Ivan Toney's hat-trick was great. And that is kind of what happened there, even though there was a bit of an injustice and blah, blah, blah. He needs to find another way of being watchable.
It is worth mentioning, Barry, Patrick Bamford's miss as well.
Yeah, he seemed genuinely bewildered himself, because he had a pretty straightforward, he'd get on the end of a cross, steer it home from close range. And instead, he performed a goal line clearance that any defender would be extremely proud of. And then he ended up sitting on his backside on the turf, just looking around going, how did that just happen? You know, it's almost as if he defied the laws of physics. That's how clever Patrick Bamford is.
It is.
And on a weekend when we're slagging off VAR, the Mbeumo goal was given by VAR, and that overturned an incorrect offside decision. So It got, at least it got that right.
It did. And really, the headlines should be about that. And that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at the City Ground. Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Nottingham Forest 2, Bournemouth 3. This, Barney, was a fantastic comeback from Bournemouth. Absolutely vital for their season. I think it's not overstating it to say. And nobody can have seen it coming. And the just, I mean, obviously football fans like it when they win, but the look of joy on the fans' faces when Jadon Anthony put that third goal in was utterly delightful.
Yeah, it was an amazing game. It was sort of like, it's how you want football to look when you don't have any investment in either team. You want a game like that. And yeah, the energy, I mean, this is why people like the league, I think. The incredible energy created by the whole situation. And the, you know, the goal scorers. The, Bournemouth are kind of a nice team as well. And I was pleased with Dominic Solanke, who did very well in the Championship, and you kind of like players to step up and do well. The Nottingham Forest experiment is fascinating, on the other hand. They have a lot of fans in the media, and there's a lot of feel-good around them being back because everyone sort of likes them as a team. They're a sort of team that you like, you know, big city team, you have fond memories. But the recruitment strategy is completely insane. I mean, it's not really been sort of discussed at all. But how is that supposed to work? What kind of hand are they giving the manager here? It would be very, very interesting to see how it works out.
Do you think everyone likes them as well because there's no sponsor on the kit? It's just so lovely to see. I mean, I'm not sure why it has happened, and it will probably change. But it's just a purity about it.
Yeah, well, the purity is that they're holding out for a massive deal that no one's offered them right. So far. Is the okay. Purity is that they're very greedy. The owner is greedy right. Enough.
That
to,
is pure,
to,
isn't it?
No, but what's good about it is when teams didn't have, when there wasn't that there, you'd have a bigger badge. The design of the shirt is designed for a sponsor's logo. So it's got this very small staff around the top and then this huge empty space. It's a really weird shirt. There's never been a shirt with so much empty space on it because it's designed to have something and that something isn't there, which is both disconcerting and also kind of cool.
How long will the Gary O'Neill bounce be, Jonathan?
I don't know. I mean, they've clearly been significantly better in the two games since he took over. I think you've got to give him enormous credit for making a tactical shift at half-time. They went from a back four to a back three, and the two wing backs got forward, and Forrest couldn't really react to that. And that would concern me quite a bit, to be honest, if I was a Forrest fan, that they weren't able to react to that. It might be that they have got all these blokes who never met each other before, so it's quite hard to reorganise, and that may come. I also just sort of, you look at the Bournemouth job, and you sort of think, well, who... What established or experienced manager would want that? It's a pretty difficult job with not a huge amount of money to go in there. So maybe it makes sense to at least give Gary O'Neill another 2, 3, 4 weeks and see if this can be sustained, because he clearly, you know, has been impressive his two games. He clearly has a connection with the players. So maybe, you know, keeping him on is the least bad strategy.
There was a particularly egregious VAR decision here as well, which pretty much went unremarked upon because of all the other ones, but that was Nottingham Forest's second goal, the penalty. Lloyd Kelly penalised for handball. It was a ridiculous decision because, you know, there was nothing he could do. And that wasn't overturned, which I thought was odd.
Yeah, this wasn't actually a VAR decision. It was the referee's decision. He then went to his screen and stuck by his guns and decided he had seen a handball. But you're right. I mean, it was ludicrously close. I mean, what, he possesses arms. I mean, that's the crime there. I don't know what he could have done there. He
but wasn't isn't that really... isn't that a laws of the game problem, not a Michael Oliver problem? I mean,
yeah,
it's a ridiculous law. It should never be a penalty. But I think Oliver might be right, given what Kalina and Ellery tell him to do.
Lloyd Kelly should just have his arms removed, amputated at the shoulders. You know, if he really wants to be a top level footballer, go the extra yard. You know, have them amputated so it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, well done, Phil Billing. That goal was absolutely brilliant. To Stamford Bridge, Chelsea 2, West Ham 1. I mean, the end of this game, I know we've talked about the Corne disallowed goal. The end of this game, Jonathan, was absolutely brilliant, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And I keep coming back to this with David Moyes. My big doubt about him, well, two big doubts about him. One is, I think he struggles with people who have not come through, struggles with players who have not come through a British footballing background. So the fact that West Ham have signed four players from the French League, plus Emerson Palmieri, who I think only played 20 league games for Chelsea, and Maxwell Cornet, who had had one season at Burnley. I wonder if there's a disconnect there. That's the sort of, you know, the sort of reasons why I think it might not quite work this season. But the other problem I have with him is he sort of has this very sort of, you know, this sort of idea of sort of 15 years ago or so, where you get a lead or you have a point you want to keep, and you just drop deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And I know I'm saying this with my Sunderland hat on, but that season when he led Sunderland to relegation, again and again and again, Sunderland letting goals in the last 10, 15 minutes. And often it was because Sunderland just dropped deeper and deeper and deeper. And it happened at West Ham. That Sunderland it was a terrible game, but Sunderland marginally better than a 0-0 draw. And then the last 20 minutes, they just retreat. And Winston Reid ended up banging one in, and West Ham get the points. And this was a similar thing. They get the 1-0 lead, and they just drop deeper and deeper and deeper. And, yeah, Tuchel makes attacking substitutions and credited him for that. And Chilwell gets on and, you know, gets forward really well. But he just handed the initiative to Chelsea that they... It was almost willingly handing over control of the game. And I just sort of think that's a slightly old-fashioned way of trying to protect something you want to keep.
But isn't that slightly harsh when you are the smaller team and you've got a point at Stamford Bridge? I mean, that's not a bad position to be in. And, you know, Corne doesn't hit the post.
No, but it's... My point is not that you try to protect the lead. I think that's the right thing to do. I just think the way you do that in modern football is not to sort of recreate Mafeking. You don't have to kind of go back to the edge of your own box. You can try and protect the lead by holding possession, by you know, not just sort of sitting deep and letting the opposition have the ball in your half and hoping you can clear it.
This was a classic case of Thomas Tuchel talking absolute nonsense, saying he thought it was a foul after the VAR, a bit like Vieira, which we'll obviously get to, saying that was a foul. It's just utterly ridiculous. I just wonder if managers should... The trouble is, isn't it, is that the touchline reporter has to establish a relationship with these managers, so they can't say, excuse me, Thomas, that's bullshit. Like, we can say it here because Thomas Tuchel is unlikely to be on the panel on Wednesday, but I would love to have been there to go, he goes, that's a foul, and I'd go, Thomas, it isn't. But like, the sort of nature of being Jeff Shreves is you have to just go, I can't ask a follow-up which will insult you.
Yeah, I get the point about... I think Jeff could do that, to be honest. I don't see what the point of Tuchel saying something completely absurd is in the first place. I mean, just say, yeah, we were lucky, but we'll take it. Thanks. We got away with one there. You know, would anyone criticise him? Would Chelsea fans be angry because he's said something completely obvious? It's not like the goal can be retrospectively added back on again just because he thinks his side were lucky.
But I think there was a point to it. I think he said that because his goalkeeper had made a mistake, and that was where that situation came from. So he was backing, you know, he's backing his man, because the real issue there was Mendy made a few mistakes recently, and goalkeeping is a big confidence position, and he's backed his goalkeeper. And I think that's why he had to maintain that was a foul. It was I probably wouldn't have done it in other circumstances.
Broja made a bit of a difference for Chelsea. They've got Aubameyang as well when he gets fit after his broken jaw in that horrific incident at his house when robbers broke in. What do you think Aubameyang's a sensible signing, Jonathan?
Probably, because he is what they need. I mean, Aubameyang brings a level of risk, but good Aubameyang is very, very good. And I think if Havertz is always going to be your sort of the focal point up front, that limits how you can play, and it probably limits your goal threat. I think in certain games it probably is the right thing to do, but having a more orthodox centre-forward I think would be useful for Chelsea, given that the sort of most consistent criticism of them in the 18 months under Tuchel has been that they dominate the game through midfield but then don't take their chances.
Yeah, I was just saying, sort of Broja should have been given a run. I thought he was excellent at Southampton. Feel that, you know, he could do that job. It looked like he did it pretty well against West Ham.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, but you know, he is very young and we don't see him in training every day, and I think with something like that you've got to trust Tuchel's judgment on that. So, but yeah, I mean, look, everything I've seen of him, he looks a very, very talented player.
Manchester City dropping points is always a story, isn't it? They drew 1-1 at Aston Villa. Barney, how impressed were you with Villa? I mean, that to get back, to hold City for that long and then to be resilient enough to get back into the game was something I did not expect.
Yeah, it was a really good, I mean, it was a very spirited performance. When you see Man City go 1-0 up and, you know, Haaland has scored, and his goal was amazing. When you went all in, he was kind of flying. It was incredible. I mean, his standing leap to put that ball in was just, it was terrifying.
I mean, the fact he can fly as well is really not fair. Like, yeah. He's good enough anyway.
I guess just as significant is where he was, because, you know, he was just in exactly the right place and, you know, didn't touch the ball that much. But I thought he actually linked the play pretty well in that game, the bits that I saw, and looked quite kind of, I mean, he is really talented. It will fit. There is a slight thing that he scored half of Man City's goals this season, which is different. You know, that has not happened with that team before. He'll soon pass last season's top scorer. He'll probably pass that in the next three or four games. So it's a different thing. It is a different way of playing. And you wouldn't normally expect a Man City team of last season go 1-0 up at Villa. They're going to win. They're going to win 2-0, 3-0. I don't know if it's anything to do with Haaland. Villa did play really well and looked really committed in that second half. They were playing for the manager, which is a big deal at that stage. But, you know, the City-Haaland thing is fascinating. Is he a monster or is he an animal? I keep hearing both of those things. He's an animal. Is he a monstrous animal? Is he a kind of a hybrid of the two? I don't know which one.
Does he get beast as well? He doesn't get beast.
He gets machine as well.
Machine,
well.
Yeah. I would go with machine, I think. Superhuman.
A superhuman machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's one of those. There's four or five categories, and he's one of them.
He fits all of them. I mean, the cross was quite good, Baz, to be fair.
It was exquisite. Possibly the greatest cross I think I've ever seen. I've never seen Ethan Pinnock. I mean, Ethan Pinnock probably has a cross like that in his locker. Or Salomon Rondon. But it was just the trajectory of the ball, the manner in which it was just out of Emi Martinez's reach. And it's nice that there was somebody there to get on the end of it.
Do you think there'll be a reverse Trent Alexander-Arnold conversation where people say you've got to start playing Kevin De Bruyne at right back just so he can put more crosses into the box? Villa are probably the story of this game though, Wilson. Like and as Barney said, like absolutely, Steven Gerrard desperately needed a performance. No one gave them a hope in this game.
Yeah, he really did. I mean, I think they've been. I mean, they had a terrible end to last season, didn't they? So I think even now they've only won 3 of the last 17. And that against Everton this season and Norwich and Burnley last season. So it's been a long time since they've beaten anybody good. In my head, I was already thinking, well, who are the candidates to replace Gerrard? And I don't think he's out of trouble yet by any means. But that, you know, A, getting a draw against Manchester City and playing as well as that earns him some credit. And B, as Barney said, it suggests that the players haven't given up on him yet.
Villa have got Leicester next, which is quite a big one for both teams, isn't it?
I mean, you could see Brendan Rodgers at Villa, couldn't you? That is a fit that seems to make sense.
I feel like every Leicester manager goes to a Villa. They swap between those. You know, once you're in the Midlands, you're sort of stuck in like a sort of valley in the Midlands. And you just sort of potter between all those teams. Manchester City are level on points with Spurs. They play each other next Saturday at the Etihad, which might be good, might not, I guess. But Spurs beat Fulham 2-1. Brian says, is there a chance that Conte's Spurs might be just sufficiently solid and dull, yet create enough to actually win the Premier League, Barney?
No, I mean, I don't think so. But there are some pretty good teams around. Not necessarily teams that will win the the Premier League, but will take points off Spurs. I mean, Conte is a game changer. I still believe that. I think with him at the helm, all is possible. But there are, I don't know if there's quite enough, is there quite enough depth in Spurs now? I mean, it's all still coming together, isn't it? I don't want to sort of sound unduly pessimistic. And I'm a big Richarlison fan. He was fun.
Yeah, he was great in this game.
Yeah, really. He's a really fun player. And I don't think we've seen, I don't think even Richarlison knows what Richarlison is quite capable of yet. His powers are still largely unexplored. I mean, I would watch him at the Olympics when Brazil won the Olympics. I watched all those games. I was there and he just ran around like a mad thing. He was exhausted by the end of it and they won and he was really good. But what is Richarlison? What's his end point? That will be an interesting point for me this season.
Yeah, I mean, next week's game, I think, is fascinating because City have flip-flopped on them half a dozen times already this season, that you sort of think, oh, they're unstoppable, Haaland's going to score 300 goals, and what can you do? And then you sort of think, well, hang on, they've actually been 2-0, they've been 2 goals behind in 2 games already this season. They've let a lead slip at Villa. And you sort of, you think, is that idea that's sort of become sort of pretty fixed over the last, I guess, 5 years or so, that you need 95 points to win the league. So you can only afford to drop 20. And so the fact Liverpool have dropped 9 already feels like a crisis. Well, maybe if City are dropping points, maybe if they are a bit more open, maybe it will just be a 90-point season or an 88-point season. And they're better. They're much more fun. If losing a game in September doesn't sort of end your season, that's better. You obviously then have a World Cup, which is a huge randomising factor, although probably to City's benefit, because Haaland can have 5 weeks off to go and plug himself into the thing that
if he carries on at this rate, he's going to score 64 goals this season, and maybe he'll increase as well because he had some getting used to the team. He could get That's up true. To 80 maybe.
Do we want that to happen? I mean, part of it will be quite funny if he scored 80.
Well, it'd be funny if he scored 80 and they didn't win the league. That's the best of both worlds.
That is true. If he scored 80 in about 200 years, people look back going, God, football was ridiculous. like that Boxing Day in the 60s where every team scored 10, or, Buster Wilmot scored 1 million goals for Huddersfield in the 20s or something, but I don't know if that's
is the record Dixie Dean 60? Is that the record?
Yeah. I thought that would be ingrained into your psyche, wasn't it? George Campbell.
Campbell, yeah, it's true. Yeah.
He overtook Campbell the season after Dixie Dean because they'd fiddled around with the offside law. Can you imagine the discussions back then in the Pinkens and the free sheets about this confounded new offside law, which is ruining the game?
I mean, I can't just imagine them. I can remember them because I've read them repeatedly.
Are there pages and pages about Dixie Dean's toenail, Wilson? He would have scored 80 if it hadn't been for that.
Well, no, because the new offside law actually made it easier to score goals. I think the idea was it slightly devalued the achievement.
Right. Okay. He's a fraud, isn't he?
Yeah. Goals per game went up by almost double between 24-5 and 25-6 as teams got used to this new offside law.
Blimey. One quirk of that Richarlison performance, Barry, was scoring and taking his shirt off.
Yeah. So he scored it would have made it 3-1, celebrated with wild abandon, removed his shirt. The goal was disallowed. But he kept the booking he got for taking off his shirt, which I can understand why, because I think it's for inciting the crowd, and they were incited even if the goal didn't stand. But it seems a bit ridiculous.
It's a daft law, isn't it? Anyway, all right, that'll do for part 2. Part 3 will begin at Goodison. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. Liam says, am I alone in thinking that the best possible result for a derby filled with spite and vitriol is 0-0? Everyone goes home in a fury. No one is happy. Disallowed goals are a definite bonus. Football at its best. I thought this game, Wilson, was superb.
Yeah, well, it's just a really, really good weekend of football, but and this was a good start to it. So, I mean, I think this game was it second last match of the day, which for Merseyside derby to be relegated that deep, and yeah, it was a good game. There's loads of incidents. Both goalkeepers were absolutely brilliant. Jordan Pickford gets a lot of stick, but I think he's now got the highest save percentage of anybody in the Premier League this season. And Liverpool, as you've been saying, aren't quite at it, and this was a much more focused, organised, committed, evident performance than we've seen for a while.
And Barney, we obviously have to continually compare Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard, and Gerrard needed a performance this weekend, and so did Lampard, and he really got one.
Yeah, but who got more of a performance? That's the question.
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know, actually.
Can they both get a performance on the same weekend? Would Paul Scholes have got a better... Or Michael Carrick?
What Michael kind of performance Carrick would have done, yeah.
Would he have got? Yeah, you know, and Frank Lampard, it's really hard to tell. It's really surprising, the relationship between Frank Lampard and Everton's fans. It's not something I expected, that there'd be this kind of... this love in, this affection, and... But it seems to have happened, and that's good, I suppose. It's nice, people from sort of slightly different worlds coming together. It's hard to tell whether he's good or not, although maybe he's getting better. You know, maybe they do seem to be playing with a more coherent kind of idea, and the stuff that people slightly laughed at, like him saying the team has to play with balls, you know, where are your balls? It kind of seemed silly, but he has been proved, I don't know, right in some way. Obviously Everton still have a lot of very good players and should be doing better than this, and they're still down the bottom of the table. But it's either an act of styling and kind of stagecraft, or I feel that something is kind of happening there with them.
Neil Mopai's balls didn't go in the goal, Wilson, which is sort of where they normally don't go. I don't know how good a signing it is. It felt like very too sort of... He had one saved and he put one wide at the post. I can't remember, but he didn't score, and that's what Neil Mopai does.
Yeah, there's that chance he had, was it 10, 15 minutes from the end, when there's sort of three Everton players breaking in the box. His first touch was slightly heavy.
And then he's sort of behind him, we scooped it. That kind
and of you thing. Sort of think, oh, it's Mopai. Let's start, you know. But he's obviously a good player, but he's not a player you would desperately want to have a game-breaking chance of 10 minutes to go. And he just sort of, he sort of stubbed it in Alisson's shoulder. So, is he a good signing? I think so, because he knits things together. Is he going to score loads of goals? No, because he's Neil Mopai.
Connor Cody's disallowed goal, I mean, the celebration was absolutely wild, wasn't it? It was utterly brilliant moment for him until it was chalked off.
Oh, so I've got a theory about this. I think he's still a committed Liverpool fan. And he was smart enough to get himself offside. He knew it wouldn't count, but he could prove himself to the Everton fans by celebrating wildly. I think he's under deep cover.
Barney, what are your sort of general Liverpool thoughts at this stage of the season?
I think that they do have an issue in the... I mean, I wrote a preview for this game where I tried to express this, but they, you know, Liverpool's kind of success of the last 5 years didn't have to happen. Like, it was a really brilliantly managed thing, and it's possible that the methodology of they did tend to exhaust teams. You know, Liverpool were the most relentless team in the country. You could see opposition players getting tired around 60 minutes, not just because of the duels and the running at you and the kind of early Salah flying down the wing stuff, but sort of very quick possession football. They had these series of drilled movements where they go across the pitch and they constantly tire you out. But I think other teams have raised their levels and looked at it. You know, Premier League is good in that it keeps on evolving, and teams have matched them in that intensity, and the team's got old together. And it's quite hard to replace someone like Sadio Mane, who is constant tackles and constant goals. It's a really rare, quite fragile thing. And I think it's about whether the meaning of that team and whether it can be re-summoned, that kind of energy, out of this group of players or out of little tweaks and additions. And that's the challenge that Klopp faces. And he's a really good manager. And maybe he can. I'm sure he can do it because he's brilliant. But that's, I think, the process they have to go through.
Jordan Pickford was brilliant in this game. Also, I like this question from Collins. And does any team revere the armband more than Liverpool? Henderson starts, then it goes to Van Dijk, but then Milner comes on. Elliot scampers around with it dutifully, passing it around, all under the watchful eye of the camera. Does it really matter? There's this huge moment of who has to be the captain when they come onto the pitch. Let's go to St. James's Park, Newcastle nil, Palace nil. I mean, this game, Barry, was pretty much all about the disallowed goal that we have discussed. Michael says, Newcastle, more fun to watch, a positive atmosphere, ultimately 7 points, 11th. Should they really be doing better?
They should be doing better for the amount of money they've spent. They've won one, drawn four, lost one. And they should have won this game, but they didn't. And they are entitled to feel aggrieved because, as Eddie Howe said last week, he just wants everything to be fair. And the irony of his comment was not lost on quite a few people. But those results aren't good enough. And while I don't think he's under any pressure whatsoever, they should be winning more of those games. And they should have won this one, even without the disallowed goal. But they'll probably start improving. And after the game, it was like with Thomas Tuchel, Eddie Howe was interviewed. I don't think it was the correct decision, and of course he's right. Patrick Vieira said, I think it was a foul, which is absolute nonsense.
It's that bullshit from Patrick Vieira. Utterly hilarious. It's how you can do it with a straight face, isn't it? I don't know, they're sort of pre-programmed. Is he defending Tariq Mitchell for pushing Joe Willock and then scoring an own goal and think it'll boost his confidence?
There was a suggestion that Lee Mason was the VAR official here and Michael Salisbury was the referee, and he's quite an inexperienced Premier League ref. I think this was only fifth or sixth game, and there was a suggestion that maybe Lee Mason bullied him into changing his mind.
Is that why we can't hear the VAR when he's like, you will change this, you will, Michael, you might have hair, but I'm part of the bald refereeing VAR mafia, and if you don't change this, the next time you're at Stockley Park, there'll be hell to pay. We'll flush your hair down the toilet. That's what will happen. That's what Lee Mason will do. Jody asks, do you think Che Adams can throw a Malteser in the air and hit his head? Because there's no way he can catch it in his mouth. Wolves beat Southampton 1-0. But the Che Adams miss was utterly hilarious, Wilson, wasn't it?
Yeah, he almost paid for trying to do a good header. I mean, sorry, I'm sure there's a more eloquent way of putting that. But if he just sort of run onto
it... If he'd stood totally still, it would have hit him.
Stood still, put his arms behind his back so they just couldn't get in the way and sort of nudged him with his chest, then it would have counted. But by sort of trying to do a proper header, he managed to mistime it because the ball was sort of looping so slowly. And then his arms were too high and his head was too low. And yeah, I mean, astonishing miss. Well, not miss, but astonishing cock-up.
Is there a case to be made that Southampton are the new Everton, as in what is the point of Southampton? I know we all relegated them in the season preview, but I mean, they should have won this game. And they lost. And that's sort of a Southampton thing now. And I don't know. Do Southampton fans think Ralph Hasenhüttl is doing a good job? I have no idea whether he's doing a good job.
Don't you think they're more interesting
not.
This year than normal? Like, they've got some really good, interesting young players. Barney, you want to come
in? Yeah, well, I feel with Southampton, I was watching them there. I feel they're a team that's got away from me. They're sort of like a friend who you haven't seen for a couple of years and then you find out they're married. Like, I'm looking at them thinking, I've not really, something's happened here that I don't quite, I always
Where's Shane Long?
Yeah, I've traditionally had this problem with Wolves, who I find really hard to understand, and I somehow can't, but it's now Southampton, who I feel I've neglected and don't quite understand. And there are quite good players, like you say, some good young players who I don't really know about. And obviously that's my problem, but I wonder if that's a problem for the team as well, in that, you know, there seems to have been a bit of change there.
Wolves are signing Diego Costa. He's been without a club since leaving Brazilian side Atletico Mineiro in January. Every part of me hopes that he's been eating solidly since January. When he turns up for his first game, he's bulging out of it. But, you know, they need a centre-forward. They need a presence up there. And that's certainly what he is. Look, we need to rattle on, but well done to Celtic, who beat Rangers in the Old Firm. We'll obviously talk a lot about Celtic on Wednesday's pod because they play Real Madrid in the Champions League. That was a massive win for them on Saturday, and it is a massive game for them against Real Madrid on Tuesday. Susie Rack will join us hopefully on Wednesday's pod to talk about the Lionesses. They qualified for the World Cup in Australia next year with a 2-0 win in Austria. Friend of the pod, Ceylon, Andy Hickman, tweeted after winning 2-0 in front of 400 plus people in a game for Dulwich Hamlet, including Simon. Simon heard the plug on the Guardian Football Weekly and went down on his own to watch Dulwich Hamlet, cured his hangover with a souvlaki, a beer and some new friends, which is the life of getting fans for Dulwich Hamlet. Jamie says, on the subject of inoffensive crime dramas, are any members of the panel Death in Paradise fans? And if so, can they rank the actors who played the lead detective? I go 1, Ardlo Hanlon, 2, Chris Marshall, 3, Ben Miller, 4, Ralph Little. I would say this is the GOAT of inoffensive murder dramas, Jonathan Wilson.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Miller first as the original. Mm-hmm.
I like Marshall quite a lot.
Maybe I go Miller, Marshall, O'Hanlon, Little. But then they're all good.
They're all good, yeah.
To be the fourth best person who's played a detective on Death in Paradise is a lifetime achievement. It's a great thing. It's more than any of us have ever done.
The thing I love about Death in Paradise is just how many events take place on this tiny island. Like it's the Tour de France. What's the Tour de France? Like, it's a totally insane place. Just like this. And also, like, wouldn't it be the prison must be absolutely chock full of really quite middle class murderers. It's all a very weird place. Every single activity.
You're sharing a cell with June Whitfield.
But have you. have you watched Ridley yet?
No, I haven't done that.
Yes, I have.
I didn't see last night, but I was quietly encouraged by the first one.
I saw the first one and knew immediately how it was going to. I mean, very early in proceedings, I tweeted.
Oh, really?
What was going to be
I
the
thought
ending.
It was nicely paced. I felt I worked out just before him. Maybe you're a better detective than me, Barry. Maybe you've just got to accept that.
Possibly.
I wouldn't mind the two of you as a pair, of detectives. A lot of people were trying to work out which out of the four of if the four of us are the A team, who is who. And it feels like it's really hard to tell, isn't it? Because I feel like none of us are the face man. Really.
None of us are Mr. T. None of us are Murdoch.
I know Barney pities the fool, doesn't he? Barney could be B.A. Baracus.
Yeah.
He could.
Yeah,
I can
true.
See him pitying the fool.
I've seen the episode go through to get him on flights. It's like.
Anyway, let's wrap this up with a musical finale. We've been talking a lot about the number of elite violinists who listen to the podcast. And another email came in from brothers Tom and David Greed. Hi again, team. Ask and you shall receive. Please find attached our string quartet performing a version of the Football Weekly theme tune. Unfortunately, Patrick Bamford was unavailable to perform. I cannot believe, of all people, Johnny Liu didn't know what a string quartet was. Performed by Avenue Ensemble, Tom Greed, first violin, David Greed, second violin, on viola, Lorenzo Macedo Sampaio, summer signing from FC Porto, and on the cello, Dan Bull. It is absolutely, have you listened to it yet, Barry?
It's
brilliant,
it's fantastic.
Isn't it?
Thanks so much for sending it in.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. The Guardian Football Weekly is produced by Silas Gray. Our executive producer is Christian Bennett, but for the time being, thank you, Barney.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Cheers, Barry.
Cheers, Max.
Champions League, so we'll be back Wednesday and Thursday this week.
This is The Guardian.